Today on Speaking Out of Place, we are honored to talk with Munira Hayat, a Lebanese anthropologist whose book, A Landscape of War, Ecologies of Resistance and Survival in South Lebanon, examines what she calls resistant ecologies in a world of perennial warfare. Drawing on long-term fieldwork in frontline villages along Lebanon's southern border with Israel, she examines war not only as a place of death and destruction, but also, necessarily, as an environment of living. We greatly appreciate that she was able to join us now during the massive and deadly new war Israel is waging on Lebanon. Munira shows how this devastation is a continuation of wars Israel has waged against Lebanon for decades, but also how both the Lebanese people and the Lebanese landscape are resisting death and persisting in life. This episode is especially useful to those wanting to know more about Lebanon, as Professor Hayat gives us an informative account of the intertwined histories of Lebanon, Palestine, and the State of Israel. Speaking Out of Place is made with support from Stanford University. I alone am responsible for its content. Thank you so much for being on the show. I absolutely love your book. It's complex, challenging, exciting, depressing, inspiring at the same time. And I thought I'd just begin with this quote to start the interview and then feed you a question after that. You write, quote, "This book is about worlds that grow in war. It explores the life that goes on in the midst of enduring conflict by examining what I call, quote, resistant ecologies, vitalizing more than human relations that persist and make life amidst returning seasons of devastation. I ask how life is lived in a place of war. War in Lebanon is by now a part of the environment. It is generative of a kind of life that continues to be lived there. So let's begin with perhaps an obvious but also very difficult question. How is the current situation in South Lebanon continuous with the main themes of your book, or how is it not?
Thank you so much, David, for having me. It's such an honor and a pleasure. And thank you so much for giving me the opportunity to speak in this moment, a moment that actually finds me, maybe for the first time in my life, a little bit at a loss at what to say. It's overwhelming and it's a layered catastrophe that for me, as I look back on my life, I'm almost 50 years old. I'm shocked that very little has changed from the moment I was born until now. And of course, the world didn't begin with me. These are generational catastrophes that are accumulating, and we find ourselves having to live with them continuously and through them. So thank you so much for giving me the opportunity to speak in this devastating moment. To answer the question, we're living through another end of the world in Lebanon and in South Lebanon. War is, as I argue and as I insist on always saying, an environment of living in South Lebanon and in Lebanon. I make this point in my work in order to shift the optics of war from that only of the necropolitics of death and devastation to the worlds that actually have no choice but to live within these unlivable circumstances. I do this as well in order to really underline the possibility of resistance to these destructive realities. I do that for a political reason, but I also do that for an existential reason. And those two things are obviously connected. When you live in a world that is out to destroy you, you can't give up. You can't concede, because then you'll be gone and you'll be dead, and that'll be the end of the story. So the resistant aspect of life is a necessity to life in these worlds, where if you look at it from any angle, you would say, life can't live here. And indeed it can't. So right now in South Lebanon, we're living through another season of war, a season of war that has been actually ongoing since, I will start in 1948, although one could begin before that. But these seasons of wars have been cyclical since 1948, since the establishment of the State of Israel on the land of Palestine. And the latest season, which began in the olive season of 2023, and now we are back in the olive season of 2024. So the olive season is October and November. We call them the Tashreen in Arabic, because October and November are the months of Tishreen 1 and Tishreen 2. So beginning on October 8th, 2023, Israel has been pounding South Lebanon with all kinds of bombs, including white phosphorus, attacking the landscapes of life in this region. And then beginning on September 23rd, 2024, this assault was expanded to the rest of the country. The scope of the devastation is quite dramatic. On September 23rd, 2024, Israel launched a massive carpet bombing campaign across the country that resulted in the death in one day of 600 people. Many people are quoting this as the highest death toll in Lebanon since the close of what is called the Lebanese Civil War, but which I prefer to call the Lebanese War. And since October of last year till now, upwards of 2,000 people have been killed and 10,000 have been wounded. In a country of 5 million people, of which a third are refugees, we have a standing population of Palestinian refugees from 1948, but we also have a large population of Syrian refugees. Lebanon is the country with the highest per capita of refugees in the world. One-fifth of the population now has been displaced. 1.2 million people have been displaced because of the relentless attacks with the most devastating weapons by the Israelis on the fabric of life across the country, in South Lebanon in particular, and in the southern suburbs of Beirut. We call them the southern suburbs of Beirut, but they are an actual vibrant and very populous neighborhood of the city of Beirut. So 1.2 million people are displaced. They're on the streets. They're in schools, in hospitals, and people are opening their homes. In my family home, we have taken in about six families, and I'm happy to report that the family who was my home in South Lebanon for the years of my field work are currently at home in my family's home in the south, where we live a bit south of Beirut. Yeah. So it's a really unbelievable moment. Obviously, when you live through the end of the world, it's always devastating. It's always catastrophic. It doesn't get easier, even though these are seasonal cycles of world-ending violence that we have come to expect and that we have lived with before. And it, just to think about the current moment in Lebanon and in South Lebanon, it feels very dark, even though I insist on a hopeful orientation towards life and resistance. And it feels like there is no horizon from which to emerge at the current moment from where we stand.
Yes. Just by coincidence, yesterday I taped a show with three members of the International Solidarity Movement who were in the West Bank, and we were talking about the fact that after the terrible murder of one of their co-workers, Israel has not relented, but in fact doubled down. And we were talking about the state of Israel now as a metastasizing violence that exceeds previous moments in a way that's, in fact, nihilistic. Between pages 44 and 66, you provide a very useful history of Israel and Lebanon and also Palestine. You're talking about the two different colonial forces of Britain and France, and then after 48, Israel's emergence. Could you talk a little bit about this intertwinement of Palestine, Lebanon, and Israel's project, of which this project we see a devastating continuation of at the moment?
Because for the last year, we've been witnessing in real time the genocide in Gaza, and because Palestine, since October 7th, 2023, has burst back into global consciousness after a couple of years of death by a thousand cuts and sort of normalization processes. And at some point, one would ask oneself, where is Palestine on the global stage? Where is Palestine in political protests? So October 7th of last year really burst Palestine back into global struggle and concern. And I was, of course, devastated for Palestine, but also a little bit glad that people were paying attention to Palestine again. Of course, from the perspective of a Lebanese, of Lebanon and a Lebanese person who grew up in Lebanon during the events of what is referred to as the civil war. Palestine has always, right, been at the heart and soul of our struggles. I grew up in what was called West Beirut, which was the part of Beirut that basically rallied around the Palestinian cause at the outbreak of hostilities in 1975. So growing up there, I was born 1 year after the civil war started. Palestine was always at the center. So when I was invited to give talks last year, because my work on war suddenly also came back into focus, I always insisted and reminded everyone that Lebanon and Palestine have always been entwined. Their fates have always been entwined. Beginning in 1948, with the establishment of the State of Israel on the land of Palestine, hundreds of thousands of Palestinians came into Lebanon, many of whom remain there today in the Palestinian camps that are spread across the coastal cities of the country. My hometown is Saida, which has the largest Palestinian camp, Ain al-Hilwe. Something about the city of Saida that I always remind everybody is that the city of Saida is a Palestinian city. The inhabitants of what is referred to as the camp are also inhabitants of the city. So there's the camp, but there's also the city, and there's also Palestinians in the city, right? So those, the camp and the city, are porous, and the population circulate within them. But also, historically speaking, Saida was always part of the Qada, the province of Acre during Ottoman rule. So Saida and Acre are sister cities. Akka, Saida and Akka are sister cities. And Beirut, in the long durée of history of this region, is a relatively young city compared to the other coastal cities. And Saida was always oriented south. Palestine was the environment of its kinship, of its trade networks, and of its sense of identity and place. With the establishment of the nation states after the fall of the Ottoman Empire in the wake of World War I, the region was carved up by the French, and the British took Palestine and the French took Lebanon. So a line which became the international border between Palestine and Lebanon was established then in the 1920s. And this was always like a very porous border. People continued to wander across it. Those who were living on the borderline tell hilarious stories, and I recount some of them in my book about how it didn't even occur to them what this line actually meant. And wandering across it would often result in all kinds of reprimands from the colonial mandate powers, the British and the French. So this was a sort of a porous line in the beginning, but it became a really hard line when Israel occupied Palestine in 1948, and suddenly Palestine was no more. And at the borders, the southern border of Lebanon, we had this enemy state of Israel. The life in these regions, where in South Lebanon, where I did my fieldwork, and that I call a landscape of war, was severely impacted by the end of Palestine or the occupation of Palestine, because it was cut off from its whole environment. And of course, there was the Palestinians who poured over the border. Many of them came to South Lebanon. So South Lebanon is historically known as Jabal Amil. This is a sort of the heartland of Shiism in the region. And it's also a continuation or extension of Northern Galilee. So it's also Al-Jalil. Those geographies don't know the borders of the modern nation state, right? So beginning in 1948, a pretty difficult situation unfolded in South Lebanon. First of all, there were the Palestinians who had arrived there assuming that they would be there temporarily and be able to return to their homes. As it became clear that they wouldn't, they were rounded up and placed in camps across Lebanon, in Saida, in Beirut, and in Tripoli. And the region there then became a sort of a launching zone for Palestinian liberation. A guerrilla war, let's say, heated up in that region throughout the 60s and the 70s, especially in the wake of the Cairo Accords that gave the Palestinians a carte blanche to launch the war for the liberation of Palestine from Lebanon. And also in the aftermath of Black September in Jordan, when the Jordanians massacred the Palestinian militants and their Palestinian constituents and threw them out of Jordan, and they regrouped in Lebanon. So beginning in the late 60s, early 70s onwards, South Lebanon became what many referred to as Fatah land, basically in an area where many artists, left-leaning and Soviet-funded and armed Palestinian militant organizations would wage their liberation war against the occupiers in their homeland from Lebanon. This resulted in, of course, attacks from Israel on not just the militants, but on everything. And this is something that I would like to underline here and keep in view as we talk about how war has developed in this region, and the war against life as an environmental concern. The Israelis have always been really good at waging environmental war. They understand that war is an opportunity to destroy more than simply military targets. Throughout this 1970s, there was an increasingly war on life in South Lebanon, and many of the villagers in South Lebanon suffered dearly because of those attacks. The Southerners are a multi-sectarian group of people. People tend to think of South Lebanon as predominantly Shia, and the Shia are indeed the largest demographic there. But South Lebanon has a huge population of Christians from all the sects. You have Maronites, you have Greek Orthodox, you have Greek Catholic, and you have also Sunnis. Many of the Sunnis who live in these areas are nomadic groups that have been forcibly settled, of course, since the establishment of the borders and nation states. So many of the Sunni groups in South Lebanon have family in the interior of occupied Palestine. And those tribes are continuous across those dividing borders. And you have Druze as well. Let's just point out that it's a multi-sectarian environment and everybody was suffering. In 1978 was the first massive invasion of South Lebanon by Israel. They pushed into Lebanon and they barreled through up until the Litani River, which is 10 kilometers removed from the Palestine-Lebanon border. They stayed there. And then they were, of course, asked to leave. The UN formulated Resolution 425, which requested that the Israelis withdraw forthwith. This is the terminology. And so then the Israelis withdrew, but they installed in their place a proxy militia called the South Lebanon Army. This was initially a faction of the Lebanese army that had broken off from the army and that had then thrown their lot in with the Israeli occupation. So the Israelis really stayed, but until 1982, behind the facade of a sort of a Lebanese proxy militia. So this is the beginning of the Israeli occupation of South Lebanon from 1978. And then, of course, this occupation didn't stop the continuing war of liberation for Palestine. And so in 1982, the Israelis invaded again. And this time they barreled through the country all the way to Beirut. They laid siege to Beirut for 3 months from June until September. It was a devastating invasion. 20,000 people were killed. They carpet bombed the cities. They took thousands of people prisoner. They set up prison camps, the most infamous being that of Ansar, that herded all men of all ages and women too, that were in any way suspected of collaborating with the liberation of Palestine. Or fighting for the liberation of Palestine. The Israeli invasion of 1982 was a monstrous invasion, and it culminated after the fall of Beirut in early September with the Sabra and Shatila massacres. The Sabra and Shatila massacres happened on the 17th, 18th, and 19th of September, and they resulted in the horrible death of up towards 3,000 Palestinians. This is after the militant organizations that the Israelis had ostensibly invaded to eject from Lebanon. They had already been deported from Beirut. They were all put on boats and sent to Tunis, but the massacre at the camps happened in the aftermath of this. So as you can see, Israel has always been going over and above its so-called military targets. And if you really look at the large picture, and if you look at each instance of this larger picture, you will see that life itself is often the target. Arab life itself, Palestinian life itself, Lebanese life itself is actually the target of their death machine or their war machine. So then the Israelis withdrew from Beirut after the Sabra Shatila massacres had been done and dusted. And they withdrew to Saida, my hometown, where they remained another couple of years until 1986. And then in 1986, they withdrew from Saida and they packed themselves behind the Litani River. And this occupation that had started in 78, they stayed there. Also, with their proxy militia continued under the leadership of Antoine Lahed, who was the head of the South Lebanon Army. And this militia was forcibly recruited from the villages of the occupation zone. And its foot soldiers were all the religious sects, because many of the young men didn't have a choice but to serve in the South Lebanon Army. But the upper echelons of the South Lebanon Army were mostly Maronite of Lebanese, who were aligned with the Lebanese forces and the Kitaib, who were the anti-Palestinian faction within the Lebanese civil war setup. In any case, during this occupation in 1982 onwards, this was when the resistance that we know today, Hezbollah, came into being. Hezbollah is a Lebanese resistance organization that was born in the devastating violence of the Israeli occupation of 1982. And their first acts of resistance were against the Israeli occupation in Sur, and also against the U.S. Marines in Beirut. The U.S. has always, from the perspective of us in Lebanon, been aligned with Israeli interests. And of course, this continues to be the case. So Hezbollah was born as a Lebanese resistance organization, really rooted in Israeli violence and stemming from the Israeli occupation, first of Saida and then of the border zone. In the 22 years of the Israeli occupation of the border zone, Hezbollah honed its skills. It actually is an organization that didn't come out of nowhere. It's an organization that came from a long genealogy, and I described this in that chapter, of resistance to Israeli violence that actually has its roots in the Palestinian liberation struggle. So the Palestinian liberation struggle and Hezbollah are genealogically connected. Many of the most seasoned and renowned leaders and fighters in Hezbollah actually learned how to fight in their youth with the Palestinian liberation movement. Hezbollah were the resistance that were victorious in South Lebanon. They were the ones whose increasing skill at fighting the occupation basically resulted in the occupation collapsing in May of 2000. And on May 23rd, the Israelis unilaterally withdrew from South Lebanon. It was a scramble. It was a mess. It was an embarrassment for Israel that they were rushing across the border without having negotiated any benefit from their years of occupation. This occupation costed the Israelis a lot, and it was no longer sustainable for them. I was there in South Lebanon on that day. I was a young journalist at the time. And I saw with my own eyes both the overwhelming joy of this liberation, but also the fear and uncertainty of those who had actually inhabited this occupation for many years, and they didn't know where their lives were going to go. So many people actually who had been collaborators with this occupation, mostly out of a lack of choices, their choices were often, how do we live here? They were left with no protection. Many of them ran across the border, but were repelled. Some were taken in, but many people actually stayed. And the Hezbollah moved in and took over this border region. And of course, the Western media was expecting all kinds of acts of violence and retribution. But what actually happened was a very orderly reclaiming of those villages. Militarily, Hezbollah took over in this area, socially in many ways too. But South Lebanon was then returned for the first time in its history to the nation state that it was included in by the Allied powers at the end of the Ottoman Empire. So this is 2000, the Israelis withdrew and Hezbollah moved in. And then there was a big desire to reabsorb this part of the country that historically had been neglected, where most of the people were very poor, that was severely underdeveloped in terms of infrastructure. But that also is where the where tobacco is farmed. The Lebanese have a tobacco licensing monopoly that they inherited actually from the French, who inherited it from the Ottomans. But this area is historically one of the poorest and the most neglected parts of the country. So there was a desire at that moment to maybe reclaim it and build it up. This was still the hopeful years in the post-war era. Post-war, I put between scare quotes, because as we know in Lebanon, war never ended. It just like recedes because the structures of war are continuously in place. It recedes and comes back into visibility and praxis. And up until 2005, this sort of post-war fantasy was still being plied. In 2005, the Prime Minister Hariri, who was basically who embodied this post-war dream, but basically set in place a lot of actually the problems that we continue to suffer from in Lebanon today. In particular, I'm referring to the financial collapse of 2019, were set in place back then. And he was assassinated in February 2005. Then in 2006, what is referred to as the July War blew over. It was an extremely vicious response by Israel to an ambush and kidnapping of Israeli soldiers on the border by Hezbollah. They had aspired to take them hostage in order to hold them as negotiating assets in the ongoing sort of prisoner exchange. Of course, as Israel has thousands and thousands of prisoners being held unconditionally and open-endedly, and prisoner swaps and prisoner negotiations are always ongoing. So this was a botched ambush, and the result was that in the aftermath of it, the Israeli war machine swung into full throttle and basically flattened South Lebanon, flattened the southern suburbs. 1,300 Lebanese civilians were killed. The amount of damage was really huge. After 2006, the war ended with a ceasefire after 34 days of fighting. And the Resolution 1701, which is now being replayed in the media as something to aspire to, was proposed by the UN. And 1701 basically is a resolution that states that Hezbollah needs to withdraw from the borderland, no Hezbollah south of the Litani, and that the Lebanese army will take charge of the border area. This idea of a Lebanese army is anyway a joke and a mirage, because we don't have an army. It's severely underfunded. And what they're asking for indeed is basically to expose South Lebanon to any kinds of occupying desires on behalf of the belligerents, which are the Israelis. So 2006 was the last big war. From 2006 until the present, this is when I did my research. I did my research in the immediate aftermath of 2006. I went to South Lebanon. And of course, being a child of war, I was very familiar with war. I wanted to write a story of war that was not only about what we see in the news, rubble and dismembered bodies and lamenting women. These are obviously big aspects of the imagery and the spectacle of war, but also wars about how the moment the ceasefire was called, people were rushing back to their homes. They were holding on to their life. They were replanting themselves in the ground. They were harvesting the bombs from their fields and from their fruit trees. They were back home. And what I saw and what I wanted everybody to see too was how life is resurgent. Life is resistant. And despite the desires of the war machine, which is very hubristic in its desire and its actual aspiration to eradicate life, that life will be victorious. And this is the hope that I have, but it's also something, it may be a hope, it may be an unrealistic hope, and I hope it's not an unrealistic hope, but it's actually a praxis for those who live through war, that the only way in which you can actually continue to live through war is to not concede to war's desire to kill you and to continue to live. So just to finalize the history of this, up until 2023, the southern borderland remained in a sort of a non-war, let's say, non-acute war condition. But of course, war was everywhere. It's people returned to their homes. They rebuilt their homes. I personally helped a dear friend of mine build her home in the border of a borderland village. She bought the cheapest land, which was really close to the border with occupied Palestine. And she put all of her money, and I put a sizable chunk as well, into the building of this home. Nobody was asking whether there was any point in building this home there, because the building of the home was the point itself, right? To be able to be in one's village, have a home there, then one has a home. So people were continuously pursuing their life paths within this environment. And the idea was, of course, that one day the war would return. But everybody said, wars like the weather here, wars like the seasons. Mm. We try to optimize our survival within this reality, but we're not going to put our lives on hold. And in October 2023, people were hoping that this season of not acute war would extend itself. But beginning in October 8th of 2023, the war returned to the region. Israel started to bomb the south viciously, in particular, the olive groves and the fields of life there. Millions of square meters of land have been scorched in South Lebanon, and many people left. So from 2023 until September of this year, 100,000 people had left South Lebanon, but now much more have left South Lebanon. So now we're back in a season of devastation. We're back in, if you see the images in the media from South Lebanon, the villages that were rubble in 2004, are rubble again, and even worse. That's the story of seasons of war in the landscape of war of South Lebanon.
I can't thank you enough for that incredibly comprehensive and articulate and compelling narrative. It's devastating. I'm thinking about one of the main things I appreciate about your book is how it both uses categories and dismantles categories. It disabuses us of our ways of thinking that come from a very different zone of life than what you're describing. And it tries to do justice to exactly what you're reporting. And I was thinking about these categories of genocide and ecocide, and you show how the two are completely intertwined, because both aim for the same thing, which is the destruction of a life world. And that what you describe as well is the resilience of both the landscape and the people. And you do it in such a beautiful language. And so I want to treat the readers to a passage that will both show the poetics and the poetry of your writing. And I'm going to ask you about how you arrived at this language as being adequate to the task. And it also conceptually gets to the heart of your analytic, which is landscapes, two things at once. And you write, this is on page 5, choose the medium of landscape. Or perhaps it chose me, for its varied tempos and different textures, its gathering qualities, its fragmented, manifold natures. Its heterogeneity is key. In this book, war is the object, landscape, the medium, and method. Landscape as medium diversely anchors being and becoming within and across the twin forces of destruction and creation, a continuous fiber through seasonal forms, rain, and shine. Similarly, war is never a singular story. Destruction for those who live it, as many do in the global south, war is also the colorful and complex, contradictory and challenging environment of living. And you make a very interesting distinction between land versus landscape. And I can't help adding in that we are going to have Shrida Molevi on the show soon. And she talks about landscape as witness in her book, Environmental Warfare in Gaza. So talk a little bit about landscape and also how you arrived at this amazing language as a vehicle for expressing your take on landscape and how it is a fitting analytic.
Wonderful. Thank you so much for this beautiful question. It's one that's very close to my heart, mainly because I love the creative, freeing dimensions, the eclectic, heterogeneous capacity, the multiple textures and temporalities and spaces of landscape. And that it also relates to the writing, which is also a form of writing that refuses also to be confined within a genre. And it's very resonant, like the landscape and the writing are both resonant. So I really appreciate you linking them in the question. So I'll talk a little bit about landscape. If you ever visit South Lebanon, and I really hope that you do, and I would love to take you there and to show you around. I've done this a lot, and it's part of my way in which to bring this world into being through the love of the people to this land. South Lebanon is an overwhelmingly beautiful landscape, and it's one that is very recognizable because of its biblical history. This is one layer of history. It's not the only layer of history in this region, since the Bible is a very known text, and because it has become quite dominant in the ways in which people approach the world, I often utilize it to draw people's attention to the beauty of the landscape, but also to its spiritual content. When you're in South Lebanon, you can't help but recognize the landscape. And when you look at that landscape, you think of themes of peace. You see the olive trees. You see the laurel groves. There's the undulating hills, the sun that sets in the west into the sea and rises over the hills. It's a landscape that transcends those really nasty human-made borders that have scarred it and destroyed it on many possible registers. So for me, landscape was really the way in which I was able to explode all ways of thinking and talking about South Lebanon, not by grounding the iconoclastic aspects of what I was doing, but to draw people into a new way of approaching this world. So when we think about South Lebanon, we're often thinking about Hezbollah or Islamic militants or Shiism or the Israeli-Arab conflict, all these terminologies that when you say them, to me, just shuts down the multiple lived realities of this place. So it just so happened that when I first got to learn the landscape, I was accompanied by two landscape architects, Jala Makhzoumi and Rabia Shibli. Rabia is a southerner, and he was one of my companions in the field in the early years there. And both of them really alerted me to the generativity of this framing. Of course, then I started to read a lot in landscape studies. I also got very enthralled with cultural geography. This was actually a moment in anthropology before the kind of the multi-species post-human turn really took force, mm-hmm. and the whole notion of ecologies, which as I came to write my book 10 years later, was already quite a dominant idiom within the field. So I was trying to grasp at a format that would allow me to speak to the richness of this world that was not only about politics and men with guns and war and UN lines, blue lines, red lines, green lines, and all this kind of stuff, but and then really opened up the world in different ways. I was very inspired by Tim Ingold's beautiful article, The Temporality of the Landscape, where he looks at the painting by Peter Bruegel, the elder, and parses the landscape in all of its different temporal rhythms. So this is why I came to landscape, because I wanted to tell a story of life in war that actually exceeded all the categories that were available to me at the time. And I realized actually being there in South Lebanon is when I would talk to people, they would actually tell me their lives by showing me their worlds, by enacting their being in this place. And of course, in a struggle like that against the occupying desires of a belligerent nation state like that of Israel, land is key, right? And the presence of the inhabitants of the land in their land is key. So, of course, there is an ideological dimension to that, but I didn't want to fall into more ideology. I wanted to show how they lived in this place. So when I would hang out with my friends in South Lebanon in the border, in what is called the frontline villages, we were literally meters from the border, the militarized, hyper-militarized border of occupied Palestine. But they were sitting in their little kitchen gardens. They were showing me their olive groves. They were taking me into the beautiful meadows that are in the green season foraged and loved. And of course, this landscape is multiply layered. It's a very old landscape that has been inhabited since the dawn of humankind, right? And you have the spirits of this land alive in the land, not in a way that is like romanticizing, but is actually real. The water holes, the caves, the rivers, the ancient trees all contain spirits that are ordinarily recognized and that are often folded into the narratives and the orientations of the people towards their land. And I speak about one spirit and one tree in the chapter of my book entitled Maskun. Maskun is a word that refers to inhabited or spirited nature, right? So landscape really was my way of telling a story that transcended genres, but that allowed me a really eclectic capacity to bring in different stories that then together would compose a sort of very loosely and generatively collaged scene that then I called a landscape of war. And so when you think of landscape of war, your first image would be of rubble and gray destruction. But the cover of my book is that of a beautiful tree re-emerging from its stump and the light of the sun in the background. And so that for me is what a landscape of war is. It's the capacity of life to return, right, in the aftermath. So that was landscape. And then ironically, it became a big thing. This was me as a graduate student. I was like grasping around for ways in which to say what I was trying to speak. And I was inspired, of course, by the whole actor network theory, STS, the sort of decentering of the human, and of course, the cultural geographers. And then 10 years later, when I was preparing my book, this idiom of multi-species, of ecologies, and even landscape has come into a recognition as a sort of a, the most generative mode of doing anthropology. Anat Singh wrote a piece with a couple of others called Patchy Landscape. And in that, they advocate for a landscape approach. I like to always say I'm a nobody, of course, and they're very famous and known. I like to say that I thought of it first, but it's okay. It felt good that what I had thought of was now recognized and that it was easier for me to say it. But I also wanted to preserve a little bit of my process and how I arrived there. So that was landscape. That's landscape for me. And then the language. I've always wanted to be a literary writer. That was always my dream from a very young age. And I still aspire to it. Becoming an academic and also an anthropologist was what life brought my way. And I don't regret it, apart from the fact that I still haven't written my first novel yet, but I really hope I can. So writing to me has always been my life's calling and the thing that I love the most. And I really wanted to be able to continue to write in a way that actually inspired love in me. And I'm often frustrated by academic forms of writing. I like the analytical sharpness. I like the ability to punch hard. But I also do think that the centeredness, let's say, of academic discourse and the ways in which people go about presenting their ideas, for me at least, is alienating and often boring, but also a little bit insular. And I wanted to be able to tell a story that allowed people to love the world that I loved, that they could feel themselves inhabiting it and living in it. And this was also a political choice on my behalf, because of course, I'm speaking of worlds where people are not even recognized as sufficiently human. People don't care about the lives of Lebanese or Palestinians enough to even be outraged when their lives are snuffed out. My writing in a way that inspires a sense of recognition or a sense of affection or a sense of love or attachment is my strategy to draw the reader in to care about the world that I write about. And of course, for me, from the very outset, I bookend my text. So the prelude is a sort of a poetic entry to war as an object. And then I have the coda, which ends it. And for me, this is really my way of also showing continuity of life, right? Within what in some cases becomes more of an academic text. And at the beginning of the book, I state that war to me is an intimate object. And I, of course, I'm an inhabitant of war, but I'm a scholar of war. And I want to be able to write those things simultaneously. So hence the writing tries to do an intimate scholarly discussion or description of life in war.
I promised to have you back on to tell us about your novel. So, but as I said, there's so much in your book that we could talk about, but we're running a little bit close to the end. But I want to say one thing to readers. A, please obviously buy the book, but the chapter about the two trees is amazing. You touched upon it just a second ago, but it to me was a wonderful illustration of everything you've talked about. But I want to ask just two things as we get toward the end. And I've already told you about this. I'd love to have you talk about tobacco. And especially on page 99, you talk about the licensing of tobacco cultivation and how that licensing reflects all sorts of political, financial, cultural, agricultural elements together, right? How this essential crop draws together all these things you've been talking about in a very concrete way. And then after we talk about that, I just want to telegraph this in advance, that we should talk about the conclusion. And again, this to me brings the specifics of what you're talking about into the largest frame possible, which is, I think, what you want. And you, again, beautifully write on page 213, this book has presented bittersweet scenes of what it is to live in war and what life in war can tell us about life resistance and survival on a doomed planet. The resistant ecologies I've explored in this book are among the last recourses available to those who have extremely limited choices and exceedingly difficult lives. Survival in such worlds is crafted within overlapping violent processes along vitalizing but also destructive relations and practices that nevertheless shape the possibility of life in catastrophic and catastrophic quarters. In recognizing these ecologies, we also recognize the inability of politics, governance, ideologies, and this sort of gets back to the Two Trees chapter, and analysis to account for, or more importantly, to care for, what ultimately enlivens and sustains. And again, I thought immediately of Juana Perennis's book, Decolonizing Extinction, which is about orangutan shelters in Borneo, and this amazing sense that she has of exactly the kinds of things that you're talking about in that domain. So could you talk first about tobacco a little bit and how that chapter really does concretize so much of what we've been talking about so far in the podcast? And then maybe we'll end with you commenting about how you want this book to be read in the way you mentioned the conclusion, in a very capacious way that takes the lesson, if you will, of Lebanon and helps us learn from it.
Wonderful. Thank you so much, David. Tobacco. You can't talk about South Lebanon without talking about tobacco. This is a cash crop that was introduced in the 16th century by the Ottomans to the highlands of South Lebanon, and it has been planted there ever since. It's a plant with an amazingly long history, and I also like to always pay attention to the continuities, not only just the ruptures, especially in places of war. It's a long history, but it's not necessarily a history that is lovely or romantic or that we can look at through rose-colored glasses. Because this is a cash crop. It's one that was introduced to the area by empire for trade purposes. It was then taken over by the French, and it was owned also by the French as a monopoly. And then it was finally then taken over by the Lebanese state. It's owned now by the Lebanese state as a monopoly. Now, interestingly, of course, the monopoly and the states, the empires, the colonizers, those were the entities that were actually benefiting the most from the planting and the selling of this crop. But what was more interesting to me was what kind of life then flourished around this weed that is also hardly a nourishing one in the history of the planet, let's say. But in South Lebanon, tobacco, in particular, since the war has become the main condition that people wage their lives through, tobacco has really become one of the major lifelines of those who inhabit the frontline villages of the Lebanese highlands. Tobacco is a remarkable crop insofar as it actually needs no irrigation, no infrastructure. It's premised on the labor of families, and this labor is largely done by women and children. It's the crop of the poor. It's one that needs no infrastructure, so you don't need storage facilities. You don't need irrigation equipment, and you don't even need vast, flat areas of land because South Lebanon is very hilly. You need terraces, various irregular swaths of flat land. And it's a weed that actually thrives within the demographics of poverty, the infrastructure of neglect, and the temporality of war, which is one that values swift time over a slow time, right? So if you look at South Lebanon, of course, you have many different agricultural cycles and activities and seasons, but tobacco is the main one. You have wheat, you have, of course, the olive crop, you have laurel trees, Of course, people have their own vegetable gardens attached to every house, but tobacco is the main cash crop and remains the main cash crop because of its nature as a state monopoly that is subsidized by the state. Basically, the state issues licenses. Those who have licenses can plant the crop, and then the crop is bought from the licensed tobacco farmers at a fixed price. So it's not vulnerable to price fluctuations on the international market. So this has been an inordinately stabilizing force in the life of the inhabitants of this war-battered region. And the Lebanese state actually, ironically, in also lining its own coffers with profits, really pursued the tobacco subsidy because it allowed people to stay in their villages throughout the Israeli occupation. So for once, the interest of the state aligned with that of its citizens during the long Israeli occupation of South Lebanon. And so the tobacco industry became like a national defiance to the Israeli occupation of South Lebanon. And as a result, tobacco is known to be the crop of resistance. They call it the resistance crop. Neftat al-Muqawami, they call it. But also amongst those who plant it, it's known as the bitter crop. They call it the Nebt al-Murra because of the, you know, only the poorest of the poor will plant it. It takes up so much labor. It's really like it's backbreaking work. The seeds are strewn in February. The little seedlings are transplanted to the fields in March and April. And then from May, June, July through August, the tobacco stalk grows in the field and then it's harvested from the bottom up. Every like sort of layer of leaves has its name. The least rich leaves are the bottom ones, and the top ones are the richest are the smallest and the most tender and the richest in nicotine. And so they're harvested throughout the months of summer. So it's a very fleeting crop that doesn't require, you know, the long durée that, for example, a citrus grove or an olive grove would require. So tobacco really, as a plant, as a multi-species companion to the humans inhabiting these areas, allowed them to hold to their lives, to their life worlds. So it's both the bitter crop and the crop of resistance. And the point that I try to make in this chapter, and in particular, I was pushing a little bit against the tendency, because another big turn in anthropology and in academia in general was the ontological turn, where people were really turning to a romanticized view of worlds that are alter to that of destructive modernity, capitalism, war, contamination, etc. And I'm saying that here we have a world that is actually premised on extractive and exploitative and toxic industries, but within them, people found a way in which to optimize the capacities for life within it. So I call it bitter life because I hold that tension without going from one side or the other. Neither am I losing hope, neither am I looking at it through rose-colored glasses and celebrating this multi-species partnership. That's the point that I try to make in this chapter on tobacco. And it's one that really allows also like a long telling of the history of this place because of tobacco's long and storied history and also violent history in this place.
Yeah, and I would just add again for our listeners that this is emblematic of your method for all the materials you're looking at. This is one of my favorites. So let's talk about how this book will help us learn from exactly this kind of doubleness, this life within a contradiction and this fabrication or a poetic fabrication of vitality and resurgence.
This is almost the hardest part to hold on to in the moment that we're speaking because darkness surrounds. These are the darkest days. These are days of feeling shattered, of feeling this really like hard, like emptiness in where the heart is supposed to be. And you try somehow to gather your resistant will to life within it. Of course, one way in which to remind oneself that one is alive is to be furious, is to rage, is to come back with a relentless anger, that then also through this anger, we find our way back to human community and the standing shoulder to shoulder with all living beings who are fighting extinction on this planet. Actually, I returned to my books to remember. Right. And it was written at a moment where one of those seasonal wars, devastating seasonal wars, had blown through, but life was like reasserting itself and life was resurgent. So it's a different moment right now because we're in the middle of the maelstrom right now and we're fighting to find the ground beneath our feet. I often say we're living through another end of the world and it's never easy. But I really want to remember that one can return to or hold on to resistant life, because resistance is not a political ideology, it's actually an existential practice. So if you are in the middle of a storm of devastation, of course, so many, too many, horribly many are killed, and then they can no longer resist, right? But for those of us who are privileged enough to still be alive on this planet, we must. And the point that I'm trying to make also is that it's not only people who are living in wars who need to resist. The reason why I have an ecological or environmental angle to the work that I'm doing on war is that I actually make the point that war, alongside capitalism, the state, and industry, all of these extractive, destructive, and necropolitical processes that are actually just destroying for profit, we all are existing within them in different degrees, and we're all vulnerable to them, of course, to different degrees. Now, in order to really be more effective at resisting war, we have to recognize how we're all complicit in these structures and also vulnerable to these structures. Now, in the global north, there's a lot of existential anxiety around climate change. Right now, actually, we're witnessing a giant storm of death in Palestine and Lebanon, but also a giant storm of death that's just making landfall in North America, right? Those two storms are connected, right? Mm-hmm. And we cannot separate them. We have to really think about the ways in which these are human-made disasters that are also, because they're human-made, they could be avoidable. And how are they avoidable? They are avoidable by people standing together and finding ways to arrest these devastating and deadly processes. So if we come to realize that war is also, apart from the obvious fact that war destroys environments, and that you mentioned the wonderful book by Shuri De Mulavi, Environmental Warfare in Gaza. In that book, she talks explicitly about how the landscape of Palestine is a product of Israeli settler colonialism. The desertification and the devastation of the landscape is a direct result of these settler colonial practices and ambitions, right? So we have to connect our anxiety around climate change and the end of the world that is coming by the by with the immediate end of the world for so many people on this planet today within those storms of war, because they are kindred processes. They're actually part of the same structures of destruction. And for those of us who are aware of that, it is up to us to really stand up and say, enough is enough. And we have to find ways of actually linking our desires for a better world across this planet in order to hopefully arrest these storms of death.
That was amazing and a perfect way to end the podcast, but it's not going to end our conversation. I think that you're going to have to come back, not only when you write the novel, but before then. And this is why I yet again encourage people to buy the book, talk about the book, because it is so rich. It's not 1,000 pages long, but it has 1,000 pages worth of ideas, because again, the language is so sinuous and complex, but also incredibly easy to read. There's something very natural about it at the same time, but you tie things together so well that make this, again, as I said, a lesson for all of us to learn from the Lebanese and Palestinian people. So thank you so much.
Thank you so much, David. Really, it was such a pleasure to talk to you, and I'm really honored.
Please take a moment to like this episode and subscribe to this podcast. This will help bring it to other people's attentions. You might also follow me on Twitter at Palumbo Liu, and let us know about any subjects you would like us to cover or people or groups you'd like us to interview.